Welcome to MSU Today on 870 AM and 94.5 FM WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour, following the latest BBC News, Kirk Heinze catches up with MSU's internationally renowned Dr. Mona.
I have the honor of seeing our Flint kids almost every day in clinic, and they're amazing. They are smart, they are strong, they are bright, they are resilient, and they're brave. They appear to be doing okay, but time will tell.
Also, the greening of Ford's supply chain, our dynamic forest and lumber industry, an effort to enlighten more of us on where our food comes from, and how to earn a Governor's Energy Excellence Award. MSU Today begins at 4:06. You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Several months ago, we interviewed Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, internationally and affectionately known as Dr. Mona. Her resilience and courage were instrumental in bringing the Flint water crisis to light, especially as the lead in drinking water affected the kids, the children. She is an assistant professor of pediatrics in the MSU College of Human Medicine and director of the pediatric residency program at Hurley Children's Hospital in Flint. And it's a distinct pleasure to welcome her back to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Dr. Mona, let's get right to something near and dear to your heart. How are the kids in Flint doing since we last talked?
Well, you know, I have the honor of seeing our Flint kids almost every day in clinic, and they're amazing. They are smart. They are strong. They are bright. They are resilient, and they're brave. So, you know, they appear to be doing okay, but time will tell. You know, we just received some funding from the state, and we're hoping to receive some funding from the federal government to build this large-scale registry, to identify the children, to track them, and to really evaluate how they are doing, not just kind of on a one-on-one basis, but really at a population health level. How are they doing? What are the impacts that we're seeing? But what we hope to show from this registry is not the impact of this water crisis. Not, hey, you know, this is what lead causes. It causes problems with cognition and behavior, and we're seeing this and this and this. But we really hope to show how we turned the story around, how we were able to provide these kids with a nutrient-rich environment, with robust early education, literacy support, school health support, nutrition support, healthcare support, which is exactly what we're trying to do right now in Flint, and how doing that proactively mitigated the impact of this crisis. So that's the kind of research that we want to share in a few years to come.
Now, you mentioned that holistic mitigation approach that you folks are doing, certainly it gets well beyond how much lead it happens to be in a blood sample type of a thing. But in terms of the funding that you mentioned, a lot of funding has gone in, but I suspect that there's need for funding for months and years to come.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've been able to do some amazing things in Flint. We have things like universal early intervention. We have universal preschool. We have a mobile grocery store. We have Medicaid expansion, literacy programs. These are amazing, amazing things that all kids need, but especially our Flint kids. But they're all time limited in terms of the support. The support comes from state, federal, and philanthropic dollars, and everything is largely supported for maybe 2 or 3 years. This is not a 2 or 3 year problem. This is something we need to be investing in for years, if not decades to come. And we do not have that long-term support to not only make sure that our kids recover, but thrive.
You mentioned a couple of programs that I personally am interested in as well. You've mentioned literacy a couple of times. Now, talk a little bit about, we'll take some specifics on one or two of these initiatives. What are we doing exactly, or what are you doing in Flint with respect to early childhood literacy?
Absolutely. And this is probably one of my favorite projects. So we know that kids in low-income neighborhoods have a word gap. By 3 years of age, low-income inner-city children have heard 30 million less words than children in, say, a middle-income neighborhood. There is about one book for every 300 kids in low-income communities. So by really 9 months, by 18 months, we already see evidence of those achievement gaps. And by kindergarten, it's almost too late to remedy, to bridge that achievement gap. So we need to act sooner. And we also know that reading and literacy promotes brain development. It's a great, you know, it's also a necessary ingredient to remedy, you know, this water crisis with the lead exposure. So, you know, Flint's a small, big city, so everybody who cares about early literacy, we got around a table from our preschool, our library, our literacy network, the medical center, and we all are now under the banner of something called Flint Kids Read. And it kind of started with a grant I received from the Aspen Institute, a $25,000 grant to do home delivery of books. That's exploded. So now in Flint, every single kid gets a book delivered to them every month from the age of 0 to 5. It's a program called Imagine Nation Library. We are investing in 2-generation literacy, so to support families, to support parents who may have literacy issues. We have pop-up preschools, so actually mobile units that are going around the community to expose families who may not be exposed to what preschool can do. And I mentioned the universal preschool and early childhood services. In our clinic, we have something called Reach Out and Read, which is an evidence-based early literacy program that puts books into the hands of kids starting at birth, and then, you know, encourages families to read with their children. And through the support of the NBA Players Association, who have been amazing, we are now investing in newborn literacy. So right when a baby is born, we go in and we talk to families about the importance of reading with their children. So we are taking this really kind of community-wide approach, investing in early literacy to promote our children's education and their success.
We're talking about how the Flint kids are doing in the wake of the Flint water crisis with Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha. Let's move to another area that I know, and you mentioned it earlier, and it's also near and dear, given all my years in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, but nutrition.
Mm-hmm. So nutrition is terribly important in this water crisis. It was important in the in terms of how we were hit by this crisis, and it's important for really decades to come. So when a child has poor nutrition, if they have an empty stomach or they're deficient in certain nutrients, they absorb lead more readily into their body. Also, if there's low breastfeeding rates, they absorb lead more readily. And we have low breastfeeding rates in Flint, like in many inner cities. Many of our moms were using this water mixed with powdered formula, and that impacts the most developmentally vulnerable age group. So nutrition plays a critical role in why this crisis was so damaging, but also nutrition plays an even more critical role in terms of the mitigation. We need great nutrition for brain development. That's a no-brainer. So we need great nutrition. But also lead, it lasts in your blood for a short period, but eventually it gets stored in your bones and really for decades. And in periods of, for example, poor nutrition or stress or pregnancy, it can come back out of your bones, back into your bloodstream, and cause that neurotoxicity all over again. So that's why nutrition plays a really incredible role to prevent the long-term consequences of the lead exposure. So Flint, as you know, has very limited nutrition access. We have no full-service grocery stores. We need kids to have ready access to great food so that their brains can grow and that they can develop and that we don't see the consequences.
Dr. Mona, you recently were the guest of Representative Dan Kildee when President Trump made his first address to the joint congressional body. And you had some reactions to what you heard and what you didn't hear. Reactions to what you heard specifically and concerns or hopes moving forward as the Trump administration gets underway.
Sure. So it was an absolute honor to be in Congress to listen to the first address by President Trump. It was an honor to be a guest of Congressman Kildee, who's been an absolute fighter for Flint. And it was quite a surreal experience to be in that room, which is really actually quite a small room. And you see the Supreme Court justices and you see the senators and you see the First Lady. Listening to President Trump, it was great to hear, for example, his investment in infrastructure. Because largely that was a huge problem in Flint. His tone was civil and almost presidential. But I would have liked to have heard more about investments in human infrastructure, investments in our vulnerable populations, more messaging on tolerance. His message did not seem very different from his previous messages, but definitely the tone seemed to be quite different.
Well, we're going to follow this, of course. I know that you've got a lot of work to do ahead of you. But what are the next couple or two or three major initiatives that you and your team will be working on?
Yeah, so really our work in Flint is just beginning. We're just beginning a lot of these programs and the assessment of these programs. And I think that what's in our near future is definitely building this registry that I talked about. This is a huge endeavor, and we're modeling it after other national registries like the World Trade Center Registry, which is on its 15th year. So we really want to build this aspirational state-of-the-art registry to support families, to get them connected to all these great resources, to identify them and to, you know, to track them and evaluate them for decades to come. So that is probably the biggest thing that we have going on right now.
Well, Dr. Mona, this is our second interview. It's been a pleasure indeed. I've been talking with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. She is an assistant professor of pediatrics in the MSU College of Human Medicine and director of the pediatric residency program at Hurley Children's Hospital in Flint. And also, congratulations again on all the great work that you're doing and your team is doing in Flint. Keep up the good fight, because nothing can be more important.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's great to be here.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, we have featured the Ford Motor Company's sustainability advancements for many years now. And why not? Ford is not only a global leader among green businesses, but it has for 8 straight years been recognized as one of the world's most ethical companies. With me is Mary Roten, Senior Manager of Supply Chain Sustainability for Ford, to tell us more. Welcome to the program, Mary, and congrats on 8 years in a row.
Well, thank you for having me. Ford Motor Company is very honored to be recognized by Ethisphere Institute as one of the world's most ethical companies for the 8th straight year. And we're proud because our commitment to ethics and corporate responsibility throughout not just our company, but our supply chain has been recognized. And our efforts in our supply chain has really helped keep Ford among the world's most ethical company.
I did a little background on this Ethisphere Institute because I had not been familiar with it, but it's a very impressive organization committed to ethics, obviously, across the globe. But tell us a little bit more about the Institute.
Well, the Institute recognizes the world's top companies for driving positive change by mandating ethical practices and promoting corporate citizenship, responsible governance, and leadership. So what that really means for this award is they've developed various categories, 5 different categories, where they compare companies against each other. And the different categories are ethics and compliance, corporate citizenship and responsibility, culture of ethics, governance, and leadership and innovation. And once a company submits all the information and all the work that they're doing in these various categories, will Ethisphere rank and file companies. And we're very pleased to be recognized now for the 8th year in a row for all the work that our company's putting forth.
We've always been impressed, as I mentioned in the open, with the blueprint, with the overarching ethos of Ford, because sustainability for Ford is very holistic. It spans environment. It spans culture and sociocultural concerns, as you know, as well as the economic dimension.
That's right. We believe sustainability really is the intersection of social, environment, and economic. It needs to be the intersection of all three in order to be a sustainable solution. And I do have to say I'm very proud to work at Ford. Ford has a culture of ethics and transparency that is the bedrock of our company. And this culture has stemmed back to the days of Henry Ford. My favorite quote from Henry Ford is, "A business that makes nothing but money is a poor business." And back in the early days, Henry Ford institutionalized the $5 workday, the 40-hour work week, and he also was an environmentalist. He believed in recycling. Actually, he started a program where he recycled the wood from shipping crates, either to the floorboards or the floor pans or the wood on woody wagons, back when the wood on woody wagons was actual real wood. Any wood that was left over, the little briskets, he developed a company called Kingsford, F-O-R-D, Charcoal Company. So as you can see, we're very proud of our heritage as a company, and with Bill Ford Jr. continuing his legacy today, it further solidifies our company's commitment to ethics and transparency.
Well, when I talk to Ford folks, I like to tell the story. I've spent some time down in Fort Myer when Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and Firestone were all hanging out, experimenting with soy and plants and doing all the stuff that seems so in vogue now, but they were way ahead of their time.
There's no question at all. They were way ahead of their times, and they still are. I've seen a picture of when Henry Ford wore a straw suit. So a suit actually made out of straw, which to me is remarkable when you think of what the times were at the time. And now today we're talking about using recycling water bottles into components on our vehicles and using the tomato scraps from Heinz tomatoes or Heinz ketchup into other components in our vehicles. And probably my favorite is our partnership with Jose Cuervo to reuse the agave plants and try to find a way to use the fibers from the plants to recycle them into interior components in our vehicles.
Wow, yeah, and some of those we've covered on this show. I'm talking with Mary Roten, who's the Senior Manager of Supply Chain Sustainability for Ford. And Mary, let's get right into your area. The greening of the supply chain and the work that Ford does with its suppliers in general and your PACE program in particular.
At Ford, I lead a team called Supply Chain Sustainability, responsible for human rights, working conditions, conflict minerals, as well as environmental performance and considerations of our suppliers throughout the supply chain. And the program we're talking about here today is our program called Partnership for a Cleaner Environment. It's a program that we piloted first in 2014, and we're now into a more full-scale rollout with over 40 suppliers participating that represent over 1,100 supplier sites in over 40 countries. And what this program is about, it's a program where Ford is sharing our best practices to reduce our environmental footprint with our suppliers. These best practices are hundreds of leading practices that the smartest engineers at our company have pulled together. And, you know, we're engineers. We have lists. We have them in lists where they help us reduce our CO2 footprint, our energy footprint, our water and waste footprint. They've been extremely successful in our manufacturing facilities. In fact, these best practices have helped us to not only achieve our water reduction target that we met, but help us to exceed our goals that we set at our company. And now we're sharing them with our suppliers. We're teaching our suppliers how they can, too, reduce their environmental footprint. And we're asking our suppliers, our most strategic suppliers, to pass on this knowledge with their sub-tiers. So then you can get a cascading effect, and Ford's collective footprint throughout our entire supply chain can be reduced.
Mary, I would imagine that the receptivity to this program would vary somewhat initially, anyway, among your various suppliers. But in general, it sounds like a lot of them, maybe the early adopters, are embracing it without much question.
That's exactly right. And that's why we piloted it in 2014. And we said, you know, we have this pretty cool idea. Let's see if it works in practice. And from the overwhelming success that we had with our suppliers from the pilot, we decided to scale it up into this launch that we have today. And I'm pleased to say that suppliers that are engaged in the program are now committed and on track to save 552 million gallons of water, which you might be asking, how much is that? That's enough water to fill 837 Olympic swimming pools.
Ooh. No, not too bad at all. The PACE program, as you mentioned, it provides tools that your suppliers can use. Let's take a look at one specifically that caught my attention. It's called the Energy Treasure Hunts. Tell us about that.
That's right. So we're teaching our suppliers to reduce their energy footprint, their water footprint, their air emissions, and as well as their waste footprint. So one of the tools that we're recommending, and it's just really a good place to start, is for a supplier to conduct an energy treasure hunt. And that we also recommend water treasure hunts as well. That's where a supplier would walk throughout their facilities and see what's happening at the facility and where are they losing energy. And we give them some ideas of things that they can actually look for when they're walking around the facility. And we give them best practices like lighting. Look at your lighting. Find out what your bills are. See if there's been any change over the last couple years in your lighting. And we really walk them through some very basics like lighting, and we get into much more complex topics like compressed air and alternative energy that take a much longer time to not only implement, but for them to get some type of return on their investment.
Yes, and you mentioned lighting, which for large corporations and even small businesses, and we've learned this on this program, I mean, just switching to LED sometimes can save a business thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on the size of the business.
That's right, and I can use Ford as an example. We've publicly talked about this already. And in 2014, we upgraded our lighting to LED technology in our global manufacturing plants. We invested $25 million to install 25,000 new light fixtures. And this one action, this one best practice alone, is saving over 56 million kilowatt hours annually, which translates into about $7 million savings per year.
So you piloted this thing, and now it's growing and growing. As you look ahead, I mean, what's the ultimate goal of the PACE program?
From my perspective, the ultimate goal is where all of our suppliers are participating. And because we've started small, we're finally starting to scale it up, and it might take us a few years to get there. We have about well over 1,200 production suppliers. Those are suppliers that work on any component in our vehicle. And right now, we're just focused on our most strategic suppliers. So our scope is not as large as I want it to be, but it's because as we're scaling it up, we want to make sure that we optimize the tools that we're providing to our supplier so they can track and reduce their environmental performance in the most efficient way.
Yeah, and I know the metrics have been very important to Ford. They've been a key component of your blueprint for years now, and so it's logical to assume that you would provide help with those metrics for your suppliers as well.
That's right. This program is completely voluntary. It's not mandatory. And we don't feel like we have to make this program mandatory because our suppliers are seeing such a great value for the best practices. And we're also leaving it up to our suppliers to set their own metrics. Ford is very metric-driven. That resonates very well with me with being an engineer. Ford is very metric-driven. But what we've realized, and we learned this in our pilot, is not every company is structured the same way. Some companies have all their metrics rolled up into the parent, and some companies only work at the supplier site. So we have designed this program with the thought that we're going to allow our suppliers to have the most amount of flexibility and to have a program that meets their needs, which in turn they will use the program and start reducing their environmental footprint. And if we're too prescribed on what we're asking, then we won't receive the scale that we're looking for more suppliers to use and implement the best practices.
Well, Mary, as the PACE program continues to expand, I mean, it would be a pleasure to have you back on the program in a year or so to talk about further progress. Also, congratulations again to Ford, one of the world's most ethical companies for the eighth straight year. We could talk about this all day. You're another one of those passionate Ford employees that really believes in their heart of hearts in the sustainability ethos.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. It's been my pleasure to be on your show. And as a former Spartan, I am more than happy to be on your show anytime. Thank you so much for having me on your show today to talk about all the great work that Ford is doing in this space.
Well, we appreciate that, Mary. I've been talking with Mary Roten. She is the Senior Manager of Supply Chain Sustainability for the Ford Motor Company.
WKAR.
I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes, visiting with MSU alumnus Mike Mordell, who first joined Universal Forest Products in 1993. He's now Executive Vice President for International Operations for Universal Forest Products International. That's a Universal Forest Products company. Mike, welcome to the program.
Russ, it's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to spending a few minutes with you.
Talk a little bit about Universal Forest Products, its mission, and your role there.
My role today is Executive Vice President of International Operations, and I oversee my division, basically handles anything outside of North America. Universal Forest Products is a very, very work ethic-oriented corporation. We were founded in 1955. Our sales this year were about $3.2 billion, a very successful company, and we're in the residential, industrial, and construction segments in our industry.
People around these parts, Mike, think of Peter Secchia, a very generous donor to MSU and passionate alumnus when we think of Universal Forest Products. Talk about his impact.
Peter's impact is almost too much to put into words. He's a driver, and he took our company from a small operation that only had a few employees to where we are today. He basically started our asset management. He did a great job of developing a culture of hard work. He did a great job of impressing his values on our corporation. And quite frankly, it set the stage for where we're going.
And Mike, how did your time at MSU, being an alumnus yourself, impact the person and the professional you are?
I love this university. It was probably the best 4 years that you could have. Back in my, from 1975 to 1979, about a million years ago when I was here, it was an area where I made a lot of my long-lasting friendships. In fact, I was with some of them over the weekend. People just don't realize the impact that a university has on your future, and it's been tremendous. So I'm glad to be able to be here and be back.
And Mike, you are back at MSU to talk with forestry students about what you described to me off the air as the dynamic supply chain in forestry and lumber. And you've said that the lumber industry operates a lot like the stock market. Can you elaborate?
Absolutely, and it does. So prices change. You know, most people, when they think about forest products, don't realize that it has to go to market. And so as a forestry student, what I knew a lot about was how to cut a tree, what happened to a tree in a sawmill, how to replant them. But I really didn't have a good base of what happened once it left a sawmill. And so what happens when it leaves a sawmill is it goes out into the marketplace. And I've seen over the years, you can see prices of forest products like 2x4s as an example. They can change 20% in a day. They can go up, they can go down. It's affected by world events. It's affected by fires, supply chain interruptions, currency, just a lot of different, mitigating situations that cause the prices to fluctuate sometimes dramatically.
And you told me forestry, too, as a career is a lot more than going off to be a park ranger, although that's wonderful, or someone caring for our forests and our national parks. Again, elaborate how the industry has changed over the years and what you will tell the students.
That's a great question, Russ. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think most forestry students get into forestry because they love the outdoors. There's a base there. And, you know, that was certainly my impetus to do that. And I thought I'd be out cruising timber and a lot of things. And then I found when I got out, it was during a recession. I got my master's degree at Texas A&M. I stayed two more years to do that because I was hoping the economy would be better. It was worse. And so I could not find a job in the woods. And I ended up moving to Portland, Oregon, and then got a job with a company called North Pacific Lumber as a lumber broker. Didn't know what one was, and which is trading lumber, according to what I was explaining a minute ago about the market. And you know, what's amazing about it is, your path never goes where you think it's going to. I've been all over the world with my profession. My base here really helped that, but I am certainly not out cruising timber today. And I'll bet half the kids that think that's what they're going to be doing, if that's what they want to do, probably won't either down the road.
And Mike Mordell, forestry is almost by definition a sustainable enterprise. Our program is very focused on sustainability, although that's kind of become a buzzword over the years. I'm wondering what sustainability means to you and how does it relate to forestry and the lumber industry?
Well, I always tell people this, forests are renewable. period. There isn't anything more sustainable about that. You're not mining timber. If you take oil out of the ground, it's not replaced. Trees grow back, always. And with good management, you have a sustained use, building material, construction block, you name it. It's sustainable, period.
And can you tell me about how forests play a key role in mitigating climate change?
They're carbon traps. And so as they grow, they trap carbon. And, you know, with climate change being all in the news and in focus today, they're important to keeping a lot of that carbon sequestered.
Tell me, as we joked, this we could almost have a three-day conference on this, but tell me more about the challenges and opportunities ahead for the lumber business.
Well, the lumber business is a very, very dynamic business. We might not be as sexy as dot-coms or Silicon Valley, but we're an integral role to how the world and the economy operates. And over time, the dynamics are, you know, part of it's political. You get a lot of people that think cutting trees is a bad thing. It is not. And, you know, what we've seen and what a lot of people have seen, if you look at a lot of the catastrophic fires that we've had over the last several years, some of that big fuel loadings, you know, maybe you could call it some climate change in there too, but those big fuel loadings, because of the lack of attention, sometimes create catastrophic fires. And I think that's it's a challenge to make sure that we do our part in the management side of it.
And again, when you talk with the MSU students, that I think you'll open their eyes on a lot of the different career opportunities, but then how do they go about being successful in the business?
Well, that's another great question. And one of the things that I'll end my presentation on today is, if I was a college student again, knowing what I know now, what would I do differently? And I'm going to cover four or five points that I think they should know and do. One of them's being a little bit more financially astute. When you're in a science discipline, well, I don't need that accounting. I don't need these numbers. What the heck? I just need to know how to do statistics. Not true. So I'm going to focus on that. Public speaking. You have to be able to sell yourself, period. And I'm going to focus that they're going to have to spend more time along those lines and be adaptable today.
And there must be a couple more. I'd love to hear them all.
Well, the adaptability is another real, that's a big one for me. Because I said earlier, you just never know where your career, your life takes that fork in the road. And you have to be open-minded. Using myself as an example, I fought being in the brokerage side of the business. I wanted to be outside. And then, quite frankly, I found myself, I was pretty good at it. And after a few years, my income got to a point that it was better than I ever would have done cruising timber or being in the woods, and I stayed. And I've never been removed from my forestry. I've been to over 1,000 sawmills across the world. It's been fascinating. It's been a great career. And if I would have kept a closed mind on that, I would have never seen it.
And that's Mike Mordell. He's the Executive Vice President of International Operations for Universal Forest Products International. That's a Universal Forest Products company, and he's a proud Spartan alumnus. And I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes. You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, historically, U.S. farmers have not been particularly good at communicating what they do to people outside of the agricultural industry. And that's for a variety of reasons. But social media have created some very prodigious opportunities for agricultural education, and the Peterson Farm Brothers of Assyria, Kansas have seized the day with great success. With me is Greg Peterson, who was recently in Michigan to speak with the Great Lakes Crop Summit. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, first of all, tell us a little bit, Assyria, Kansas. Tell us a little bit about the farm operation.
I live on a fifth-generation family farm, and we primarily background beef cattle in the feedlot, but we also grow wheat, corn, soybeans, milo, and alfalfa. And it's my brothers and I and my dad, and then my mom and sister help some too.
Yeah, your sister's an honorary brother, I noticed from your website, right?
Yeah, yeah, we try to include her as much as we can, but she's not always always wanting to be part. You know, she's pretty shy.
And although this is Spartan country, you folks are strong Kansas State people, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah, we are big Wildcat fans, but as I was saying when I spoke, you know, we can, you know, that's land grant universities, we got to stick together, so
absolutely.
Same team.
Absolutely. Well, you folks have really gone out and put social media to work explaining what farmers do, what you folks do on the farm. What got you and your brothers into this?
About 4.5 years ago, I was majoring in ag communications at K-State and just was kind of around that quite a bit. And so I came up with this idea to make a music video about farming, which eventually became a parody music video. And it was just supposed to be a small little thing. And the next thing we knew, we posted it, and it just blew up. And we've pretty much been going ever since. And so now we make YouTube videos. We have all of our different social media pages. And it's just continued to expand over the years and has been pretty cool.
It's been very successful. Over 40 million hits on your YouTube. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by parody?
So we take like the popular hit songs you'd hear on the radio, and we change the lyrics of those songs to be about farming instead, and then make a whole music video to go along with it. And what's really cool about that is by doing parodies, you're taking the popularity of the original song, and it's causing people to want to watch your video because they recognize the original song. And that's how we draw in a lot of urban folk into watching our videos.
So the lyrics are yours, but the music, that's protected by copyright. So the rights to that you have to pay for, I presume.
Kind of. It's like you can upload it to YouTube, but you can't get any revenue from it. So normally we get paid for our YouTube videos from ad revenue. But with parodies, that goes to the original artist. And also we can't sell the songs on iTunes, stuff like that.
So who are some of the artists that you parody so that our listeners may recognize?
Katy Perry, LMFAO, AWOL Nation, Psy. Let's see, what was our most recent ones? 21 Pilots.
What are the messages that you guys are trying to convey?
We try to not only educate people about who farmers are and what they're doing, but also balance that with entertaining people. So the YouTube videos are great because, you know, it's hard to sit someone down and make them watch a video about farming that's pretty bland and fact-based. You know, we try to have a balance that keeps them engaged and is enjoyable for them to watch, but also communicates a lot about what farmers do.
Yeah, because in the YouTubes I looked at, although you guys were having some fun in there as well, but there were a lot of scenes from your farm operation, and not only your farm operation, but farm operations all over the world.
Yeah, we filmed our first couple videos exclusively on our farm, but as we've continued to make videos, we really try to pull in video clips from other people or other sources that really give a broader glimpse at what agriculture is everywhere.
My guest is Greg Peterson. He and his brothers and his mom and dad farm Peterson Farm Brothers in Assyria, Kansas. They're using social media to communicate some good news about agriculture. Do you have any idea from metrics about who's listening, who's watching, who are you reaching?
So we get
some analytics
back from our videos, and it's pretty balanced overall. I mean, there's a lot of different ages, a lot of different people watching our videos from different places. We do know we're reaching people in the cities. You know, you get a lot of comments from people in the cities saying like, man, I've never seen a farm before. I've never watched a video like this before. And they're just asking really, you know, questions that we in agriculture are just like, wow, how can you even ask that? But you know, it's good. It's good that they're learning and they're thinking about farming for the first time. Honestly, the most popular age group is probably like moms, not only for the moms who are watching the videos, right, but for all their kids. So we the analytics say moms, but we're pretty sure that's kids, little kids watching our videos.
So you're talking about these millennial moms with kids that may be in, you know, elementary school, middle school kind of a thing.
Yeah, we have a lot of kids who watch our videos.
Now, what are the kinds of questions that may surprise you a little bit that you get?
Oh, man, we've had... We have, you know, people who ask anything from, you know, like what is a farm? Like they've never even explored the concept of a farm before. We had questions like, I didn't even know people in Kansas had the internet. Like, is this for real? Like they're, you know, just misconceptions. You know, some questions like, where are the overalls? Like, where are the old grandpas? They're right. Supposed to be the farmers. Or
the straw hat.
Yeah. Or, you know, where's the immigrant labor? Stuff like that. You know, conceptions from California, places like that. It's, you know, it's not like that throughout the whole country. And so that's what we've learned, is that agriculture is so diverse. Just because a farm looks like that in California doesn't mean looks like that in Kansas, doesn't mean looks like that in Michigan. It's just different all everywhere you go. So that's been cool to see.
I was impressed on one of your YouTubes. I can't remember which one, but you did feature Michigan apple production.
Yeah, yeah, and
you were
bouncing
all over the country, which was pretty cool.
I actually got to tour apple harvest and a lot of different vegetable harvests. One time when I spoke here, I think a couple years ago. So that's kind of what inspired that.
Well, let's promote your website, too, and your blog. We haven't talked about that yet, but when I first hit your blog, it's PetersonFarmBrothers.com. Pretty straightforward.
PetersonFarmBros.com.
Bros. Yeah. That's right. I'm sorry. Yep. BROS.com.
Yep.
Okay. PetersonFarmBros.com. First thing you see, 17 myths about farming, and you really don't shy away from the really tough ones.
Yeah, we and that took a couple years to do, right? Because it's hard to address some of those things, and it's hard to get in that conversation. But as of, you know, 4 years later, we've pretty much touched on everything we can, ranging from GMOs to pesticides to organic and conventional to Monsanto. I mean, every last thing we've tried to write something about to give people what we think is the truth.
Are there one or two of those 17 myths that you get a lot of questions about?
I mean, yeah, GMOs,
and GMOs
is huge. And then just, you know, a lot of activists on there when we're talking about animal agriculture. And so we deal with a lot of response to those. And we just try to do our best to answer people the best we can.
Now, you folks are very busy with a large farm operation out there. This takes a lot of time, you and your brothers and your sister, your folks. I mean, you're going to be able to continue to do this. The power of social media is amazing. I know you're busy trying to build your farm operation.
Yeah, kind of the unique thing about where we're at right now is that our farm isn't quite, you know, big enough to support four of us full time. So Kendall's still a full-time student. And I am basically full-time with speaking and Peterson Farm Brother, you know, social media content. I pretty much do all the behind-the-scenes work for what we're doing. And then Nathan's full-time on the farm with Dad. And then Kendall and I work part-time. So that's kind of how we're able to do that. And hopefully in the future, yeah, we'd like to farm full-time. And that may mean backing off of this a little bit. But that's always been the goal, is to reach that point someday.
Greg, last question. You spoke at the Crop Summit, Great Lakes Crop Summit recently. What were one or two take-home messages? You were talking to your fellow agriculturalists. What'd you tell them?
Basically just touched on, you know, why we need to advocate for our industry and some of the ways that we can do that. And, you know, really just how important it is to be proactive and just get started somewhere. You know, you don't have to make YouTube videos with millions of hits. It can start just in your community, the people you're interacting with, people you know, just being ready to be a voice and tell your story. And so just kind of encouraging them to do that and, just doing the best that they can.
Well, we certainly appreciate the Michigan Corn Growers making you available for this interview. I've been talking with Greg Peterson. He was recently in Michigan to speak at the Great Lakes Crop Summit. He and his brothers and parents own and operate Peterson Farm Brothers in this area, Kansas. Continued luck with social media and telling agriculture's story.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, last summer, Russ and I attended the Governor's Energy Excellence Awards Ceremony, at the Michigan State University Wharton Center, and we had the opportunity to interview several award winners. Well, the 2017 competition is underway, and here to give us the details is Mary Templeton. Mary is the Executive Director of Michigan Saves and Chair of the Award Steering Committee. Mary, great to see you again.
Good to see you again. Thanks, Kirk.
We had such a great time last year. I think we got two shows out of the award winners. I mean, it was amazing, the entrepreneurial spirit in Michigan. But you're underway again this year.
We are. This is our third annual Governor's Energy Excellence Award, and we are so excited to be able to host this again. This is an opportunity for somebody who is committed to reducing energy waste to get highlighted. We know there are so many different projects going around, so many different homeowners and businesses and churches and schools and contractors that are doing really, really effective work at reducing energy waste in our state. And this awards ceremony takes the highest level of our state and acknowledges the work that they do. We think it's really, really important because these people can be examples to other people who are doing really good work.
Well, give our listeners an idea of what the different categories are, because I know you have several categories you recognize.
We do. We have 8 different categories. And we usually recognize 3 finalists in each one of those categories. There are 3 that are kind of high-level categories. There's one that's an innovator of the year. That's presented to somebody who's doing something really innovative or creative. It could be a person, an organization, a program, or a company. Another one is a contractor of the year. So these are the contractors. These are the people that are doing work in people's homes and doing work in people's businesses, schools. Another is best communication, education, or program. This is something that is presented to an organization that's overcome that barrier of communicating the benefits of energy efficiency. They've maybe developed really effective communication tools or marketing campaigns. I think last year we awarded someone who was doing work in schools, educating schools about energy efficiency and stopping energy waste. And then we have 5 categories that recognize best projects. Now, one thing to mention about these project categories, the work must have been completed in 2016. Okay. So that's a qualifier that's really important that people need to recognize. So the different projects we have a residential project. Everybody lives in a home. If you've done really good energy efficiency work, highlight it. This is your chance to attend a really fun yet intimate acknowledgement and celebration that includes the governor and all kinds of other resources. And you get, you know, a nice award. You get to attend the event. It's a beautiful lunch. Really, really a nice opportunity to get
recognized. Well, I can vouch for that from personal experience. You mentioned the Innovator of the Year Award. I've got to tell a quick personal story, but last year it was Terra Caloric out of Alpena, Michigan, geothermal units in your home. Well, I have one installed in my home, and it was a direct result of the interview we did at the awards ceremony last year.
That is excellent. That's exactly the kind of thing that this awards ceremony is intended to do. It's to recognize those really important things going on and then have people like you, Kirk, take advantage of it and then just continue the momentum of reducing energy waste in our state.
Well, as I remember from last year, the range was amazing. You had a casino resort, Odawa, I think, all the way to Habitat for Humanity in Kent County. I mean, and a couple of very large companies as well.
Yeah, we did. We had a huge, huge range. And let me continue on those best projects.
Sure, yeah.
Because I mentioned residential. We also have commercials. So those are private entities. I think, just a business, a restaurant, somebody, you know, maybe a church or any kind of commercial entity. We also have a best projects in the public category. So that's a public sector entity. It might be a school. It might be a fire station or your municipality who's done some really good work. We have industrial manufacturing. So for example, Cargill in St. Clair won last year. They did some really creative work. They replaced a couple of boilers.
Yeah,
and then they used the steam to produce energy for their facility. So it was kind of a closed loop system there. And then finally, we have agriculture. We have a lot of farming going on in our state, and we have some really excellent work going on with reducing energy waste in our farming community.
And it's important to note, and you mentioned it earlier, Mary, but the Governor's Energy Excellence Awards are part and parcel, a key component of his overall energy plan for the state. And this really emphasizes the conservation aspect of energy use.
It does. And it's something that's available to everyone. Everyone can take steps to reduce their energy waste. And it's really, really important because the cheapest and most effective energy that we can produce is the energy that we never use.
Absolutely. Mary, where can folks get the application information?
They can get the application information at myenergyexcellence.org. So myenergyexcellence.org. MI, you know, mm-hmm. It's the abbreviation
Very
for Michigan.
Nice.
And if people have questions, they're welcome to call Michigan Saves.
Okay.
We are the chair of the steering committee. That we have a number of organizations that are represented on the steering committee. And our phone number is 517-484-6474. So if people have questions or they're not sure of, you know, what the process is for either nominating themselves or at one of the eight categories, they're welcome to call us or go to myenergyexcellence.org. Also on that website, you can see pictures of all of the other finalists from the last 2 years. You can read about their stories. You can get inspired by them. There's a lot of good information out there.
And again, the deadline, though, is coming right up. So
it
people need to know that.
Right.
March 31st.
March 31st. That's right. So get your application in. Don't wait to the last minute if you can. Get it in. And one of the things that I think is really important to mention as well is if you nominate someone and that person is selected as a finalist, you get to attend the event along with the person that you nominated. So nominate your neighbors and your friends and your churches and the businesses that you attend, and you can attend the event as well.
Well, Russ and I are looking forward to attending it again this year. It's the Governor's Energy Excellence Awards. I've been talking with Mary Templeton. She's the Executive Director of Michigan Saves, and she's chair of the Governor's Energy Excellence Awards Steering Committee. Mary, great to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for having us.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. WKAR. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.